Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
When you go to the police, why didn't you do something? She said, no, that's not our way. You know, that's not the Amish way. We're not supposed to contact outside authorities. I just felt this sense of doom. It started when I got in the community, and it just got worse and worse and worse. You know, I'd grown up with a psycho stepdad and a sadistic mother, but I hadn't grown up with the idea that the entire community was like in on the plot.
Right.
Yeah, he started sexually abusing me. Right from the second day I was there. He would come up behind me and he would touch me and see if I would make a reaction in front of, you know, the kids or his wife. I've heard that it's something they sort of get off on, some sexual predators, but I was quiet. I mean, he was the bishop. Who was I going to tell?
Right.
The minister, the deacon? And if I did, the first reaction was going to be, what are you doing to cause it? You know, everybody in your peer group is going to know, so it's better to be quiet. I put up with it. It got worse, worse. You know, he was exposing himself and he was laughing. He was doing it for kicks. After I'd been there for about 6 months, I went down in the basement one day and I caught him with his daughter. I couldn't go to the police or I was going to get in trouble. And how would I get to the police in the first place? I mean, we were 6 miles out of town again. We didn't have a phone. Even if I wanted to write them a letter, everybody goes through your mail. They count stamps. If a stamp is missing, you're going to take the buggy and try to get down the road. I mean, they're going to get on a horse and catch you before you get anywhere. It's like the Amish are a sovereign nation and they can do whatever they want, but they're not. They're not a sovereign nation.
Hey, my name is Shalise Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. If you're only listening and you'd like to see our faces, you can go to our YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness. It means so much when you subscribe, you show us that you are an advocate for these people who are bravely coming on and sharing their stories, and you leave those words of encouragement for them. It's so amazing to see what you guys are saying to our guests, and it really helps boost the algorithm so more people can become aware of these groups and do something about it ultimately. So today's guest, I'm so excited. I actually have her in studio. We've gutted everything and changed it around. So this is our first time we've had someone in studio the way that we're set up now. And it's so exciting. We've been in contact 4 months. We've been trying to make this happen. We finally found the perfect time. And we're going to be talking about her life growing up in the Amish community. Actually, her story starts way before that, before she even went to an Amish community, how she was able to eventually escape and acclimate. There's so much to her story. In fact, she has a whole book about it called Tears of the Silenced. Highly, highly recommend. I listened to it on Audible and it was fantastic. So I'm going to be popping in, asking a bunch of specific questions about her story because it's so detailed. So thank you so much for joining us, Misty Griffin.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Finally here.
Yes, we made it. And I forgot to mention, you were a huge reason, maybe even the reason that Sins of the Amish was made.
Yeah, that Sins of the Amish was picked up because of my book.
Oh, so awesome. So we've had plenty of people from Sins of the Amish on, yeah. And it was just a fascinating, eye-opening documentary on Peacock.
Yes.
And wow, it was, I think it really kind of blew the lid off of Amish communities and what people had romanticized or thought them to be. Mm-hmm. And so getting the word out about all of the abuse that's going on, the systemic problems, it's such an important thing that you were able to get that made.
It took a lot of work, like 3 years pitching all different studios before Peacock finally picked it up. But
oh, wow.
Yeah, it's the first documentary made about, you know, sexual abuse cover-up among the Amish, among the Plain communities. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was pretty big deal for me to get that out there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I appreciate you coming here today because you're in Pasadena and I was like, oh, just pop on over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, your story. I think we need to start way in the beginning before you even went to the Amish because it definitely leads into how you were able to kind of sink yourself into the Amish at such a late age, mm-hmm. where that's not normally the case within the community. So wherever you want to start with your early childhood.
I mean, probably from the beginning, you know, my family was from the South. Most of them were not educated at all. They
were just full of domestic violence, drugs, crime. And, you know, that's how my mom grew up. So my mom had three children with her stepfather by the time she was 19 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And she actually married her stepfather when she was 19. And I think you can see how my mom progressed into what she was. I mean, she... There's no excuse for what she did to me and my sister, but you can kind of see how that abuse led her into more abuse and led her into the situation that, you know, became my childhood. Mm-hmm. When she was about 21 years old, she met my stepfather, who was in his late 40s already. He was the one that had this idea, you know, that we should be Amish, we should move away from society. You know, that's how God wants, you know, a man to have a wife and children and, you know, be the king of his castle and not have any outside interference. That was kind of his story, you know, and women should obey the man and, you know, children should obey, you know, their mother and father. And that's it. No government interference. You know, the parents can do whatever they want with the children because that's what God wants, pretty much. She was in her early 20s, and, you know, my stepdad was in his late 40s, and I would later find out he was actually a child molester who was on the run. Mm. So really his story of wanting to get away, you know, to be away from society and all of this, there was actually a lot more to the story than that. He was actually wanted for child molestation in several different states. Mm-hmm. So...
And so you suspect that's why he wanted to be Amish, because you have certain religious freedoms from the government?
Yeah. So he was born in Pennsylvania, and he would go to family reunions and he would visit the Amish. And he actually told us when we were kids, he's like, if you're Amish, nobody's going to touch you. You can do whatever you want. You know, people love the Amish. People idolize the Amish. You know, he knew this. And I connected with his ex-wife a few years ago, and she said that he tried to get her to become Amish, to live Amish. He kept her on a mountain for 10 years, isolated on a mountain, wouldn't let her visit her family. So it was just like growing up, there's so many things that you don't know as a kid.
Yeah.
But then you later find out and it makes a lot more sense. So basically he wanted to be isolated away. He was scared of the police. For a good reason. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to be isolated away so he didn't have to fear, you know, being arrested or anything like that and have children to abuse. That's what he wanted.
Yeah. And that's what he ended up doing with you guys, is keeping you isolated on a mountain. Yes. So that was a huge part of your story. Just going through everything that you had to deal with as a child, not even being able to speak to your sister on a normal basis, having this kind of code of trying to communicate with each other. I mean, it was so intense just from what you have written in the book. And I know that you said you cut it down in half. Yeah. So I can only imagine some of the things that you had to deal with. But it just seemed like there was no escaping. You did try to escape at one point.
Yes. So growing up, it was very methodical how my stepdad sort of orchestrated everything. From the beginning, I think they didn't plan ahead that, you know, someday these girls are going to get older. They're not going to be little kids that we can beat forever.
Yeah.
He started making these rules that, you know, you can't talk to each other. You can't do anything together. You can't be together. One girl has to be inside cleaning the house. One girl has to be outside on the farm. He always tried to keep us apart. And if, you know, he caught us together, we would be punished. So that was part of his plan. That way, I think he thought, you know, we couldn't escape. But, you know, we were sisters. We'd whisper in the night. You know, we would make plans. And when I was 18 and a half, I finally did try to escape. We had been up on that mountain for years. We were dressing Amish. You know, we were pretty much completely isolated. And, you know, we didn't know that if we went to the outside as kids, that they would help us. Because they always told us, you know, they'll take you away. You'll be put in a foster home. You know, they kids every day in the foster homes. And, you know, it's just so much worse than here. But I did know that when you're an adult, you know, it's illegal to beat up an adult, you know, I thought adults have rights. You know, that's so sad. I didn't think as a kid I mattered, but I knew that once I reached adulthood, 18, that I had some rights. So that's when I finally tried to escape. I was going to go to the police. I was going to try to go to the police and get help. But, you know, we were 6 miles out of town on a dirt road. Of course, they caught me before I got like a mile. So, yeah, then I was taken back. to the ranch, and you know, they said, we've been in contact with this Amish community for a while, and we're going to take you girls there for a trial and see if they'll adopt you into the community. And to me and my sister, we were like, wow, you know, escape. Why are they doing that? I later found out that they had a plan. They thought that we were going to fail becoming Amish because to them it looked so hard, mm-hmm. you know, because they were older, and they thought we would fail and the Amish would send us back. That's the only reason they were letting us go.
But even then, what do they gain from that, from sending you if you were to fail and coming back? Just like a way to have more control over you?
Well, my mom was sadistic. You know, she loved to torture people. Like, the more you cried, the more she laughed. I mean, the more you screamed. She loved to inflict pain on people. You know, we had my grandmother, my aunt living up there with us too. And my stepdad, I mean, I think he was a psychopath. I mean, he loved to torture animals. Mm. He liked to torture, he always liked to say, you know, you're mine. You know, if you look at the picture, there's a picture I put up online of him taking a picture with me and my sister. It shows him holding on to both of our arms like this. I think he liked to, he hated women. I mean, he always said, like, that you don't ever hear of a woman angel. I mean, he just thought, he wanted to think, I think because of his own demons, he wanted to think that women were evil and they were causing him to sin. I mean, that's, and I think that he wanted control of us. I mean, he was sexually abusing us and physically abusing us and using us as slaves. I mean, we ran the entire operation while my mom and stepdad did nothing. They pretty much just went into town and sold, like, crafts that me and my sister made, you know, animals that we raised. I mean, we were slaves.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And they really kept you from town. I remember there's a few scenes in your book where you were laying in the back of a truck bed and you weren't able to even be seen by anyone in town. So you really didn't have any sort of idea of what the outside world was like, did you?
When I grew up, I had less exposure to the world than most Amish kids have. I mean, they literally kept us in the truck, on the mountain. If they needed our help, that's the only time we got to go somewhere. And then we had to stay right next to them. We were not allowed to say a word to anybody unless they nodded their head. I mean, they just had complete control over us. And we knew it. I mean, if we wanted to go ask for help somewhere, you know, even if we wanted to try to escape, it was pretty much impossible. And as a kid, I didn't know if I went and asked somebody for help, if they would actually even help me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought that parents literally had control over you until you were 18. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that a kid, it really mattered if you were being abused. I didn't think anybody would care.
Wow. Yeah. And let's talk about the education side, because they had pretended to homeschool you, but really weren't giving you any education.
Yeah. So my mom, she had this, like, scheme going with the government. She gave them a fake address, and we actually lived like 200 miles away from that address. And, you know, she was getting checks for my aunt, for my grandma, for me and my sister, for herself. And she was saying that my stepdad was her landlord, you know, so they weren't, like, you know, she didn't have, like, a partner. She was like a single mom taking care of all of these people. So she was getting all of these government checks. And the reason that they had us doing any schoolwork at all was just in case the state wanted to check up on us or anything, that they could show that, you know, we were doing something, that we could read, that we could add. Mm-hmm. So they had us being homeschooled through rod and staff, but really we weren't being homeschooled. I mean, I got to the fifth grade math book, but basically we just, you know, wrote down the answers and copied the, you know, wrote down the problems and copied the answers from the back. So when I left, I mean, I couldn't even multiply two digits. But, you know, the one thing that me and my sister did have going for us, that we were both naturally good readers. I mean, we just picked that up really early. So, but as far as education, I went into the college when I left, and they gave me some sort of assessment, and they said that you have about a second or third grade education. Oh, wow. But I got 100% in reading comprehension.
Yeah. So. I'm sure that was a way to escape into books.
Yeah. We had neighbors. I mean, that's the sad thing, that neighbors knew that, you know, stuff was going on. And we had this neighbor that would, like, leave a bag of books or a box of books by the end of the, you know, way out at the end of the lane and like point and nobody's watching, we'd run out and grab them and hide them and read them, you know, Anne of Green Gables, yeah. Uncle Tom's Cabin, all of those kind of books.
Looking back now, I'm sure you're like, why didn't they say anything? Why didn't they do anything?
I've had many of them contact me. Like my really? Book made the rounds of that little, that county.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody said, yeah, there was lots of talk about you guys. You know, this one strange Amish family up on the hill, the girls, you never see them. And the saddest thing is, one lady said, she's like, it's like one day you girls just disappeared and nobody ever saw you again. And we went and we talked to your mom and said, like, where are the girls? Oh, they're in an Amish community in Pennsylvania, which wasn't true. I mean, we weren't in Pennsylvania. My stepdad always said, you know, I could chop your heads off and bury you under the tree and nobody would know. And he was so right. Like, that is exactly what could have happened to us. And, you know, we were just in an Amish community in Pennsylvania somewhere.
Yeah. And I don't think, well, you already said it, they didn't intend for you to succeed at the Amish community. And they probably regretted it because they lost a worker bee to do the stuff around the farm.
They tried to bring me back. When we went to the community, my stepdad, he purposely was sabotaging things. Like as the dad, he was supposed to tell me, you know, tell her not to do this. Tell her we don't do this. I mean, because we were raised in the clothing and like the sort of the lifestyle. But when you actually get in the community, there is a rule all the way down to the underwear. I mean, there is a rule for everything. And you don't know that just coming in. So
yeah.
As the dad, he was supposed to tell me this stuff, and he never did. Sometimes he actually told me to do the opposite. Oh. And then there's like thinking, she's such a bad girl. She's not.
She's rebellious.
Yeah. And then I told, you know, I finally figured out what was going on. My sister told me that she knew. And, you know, I was like, he never told me any of this stuff. And they were getting suspicious that something was just really strange. So they actually ended up believing me.
Wow. Let's talk about that transition. So you said 18 when you went to the community?
Yeah, I was almost 19. It was like a few days after 9/11.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because after all of these Amish interviews, moving into a community is not very common. And I found it interesting that you had mentioned in your book, they wanted you in the community to help with the bloodlines. Mm-hmm. So you go, oh my gosh, because there's too much intermarrying, I guess.
Yeah.
And so they're accepting of you. You move into a home with, was it 12 kids?
The one I moved into, they had four.
Four children. I don't know where I got the 12 from.
Oh, the original family like that welcomed us in, you had 12 children, yes.
Okay. So the original family that you went to had 12 kids.
Yeah.
You're 19. You're trying to learn the language. Let's talk about some of the things that you had to adjust to.
I mean, I didn't know if they were going to let us in. I everything was just so strange. But we actually had a meeting with the ministers, and they actually said we need new bloodlines. I mean, it sounded so strange. I mean, me and my sister were like, new bloodlines? I mean, we didn't really know a whole lot about the Amish, even except their history, where they came from. We're like, okay, new bloodlines, sure, whatever, whatever to get out of here. We'll pretty much do whatever. So that's what they literally told us. And then they said, we're going to give you like a 1-year probation. We'll take Misty first, give her 1-year probation and see if she can follow the rules. Because we cannot have a teenager, you know, setting bad examples for our teenagers. And this was a very, very strict, one of the strictest Amish communities in the United States. So I started, you know, getting into the community. I went to live with a family that had four children, and I had to learn how to pin the dress, how to wear the slip, you know, to wear the head covering at night. I mean, I can't even remember all of the rules. Like when you're sewing, you have to make sure the apron belt is 1.5 inches, the hem on the sleeve is 1/2 inch, the hem on the dress was 2.5 inches, the hem on the head covering was 1/2 inch. Like there was everything was completely detailed down to the width of the hem. And I was in a hurry. I remember making my first dress. I was in a hurry and I was just sewing, you know, trying to get done because all the kids were in the background. And I made the hem on my sleeve too wide, 1/4 inch too wide. And my Amish mom, she tore it out, made me do it over. She's like, no, you can't have this. You're going to get in trouble. She made me. Yeah. It was so, I mean, to say everybody is in uniform, they are literally in uniform. I mean, everybody is the same.
Down to the colors, right? What you can wear to church.
Down to the colors of the dress, the colors of the underwear, what kind of underwear. I mean, if you're out of ordnung, you know, that's what they call it, the rules, with your underwear and somebody sees it on the clothesline, they'll report you. Yeah. I mean, everybody's always looking at everybody's clothesline to see if they can see something to, I mean, they love to report each other. So, yeah.
What were the rules with the underwear?
They couldn't have any, like, name brands. You couldn't have Calvin Klein underwear.
Oh, so you didn't have to make the underwear?
Some families did. You know, there was a lot of this, I'm more humble than you are. So, yeah, so some of the families did. The one I lived with, we were allowed to wear store-bought underwear, but they had to be, you know, very modest, white. you know, the tags were ripped out. They could not have any, like, name brand on them anywhere. They just had to be, I think we got Walmart, pretty much Walmart, you know, Hanes or Fruit of the Loom, something that, you know, didn't have anything on it. So, yeah, they had to be usually white and no names on them or anything.
So was your job as a 19-year-old coming into this family, you were supposed to be watching all of these kids, right? What was that like going from complete isolation, you can't even talk to your sister, to now you have this house full of kids that you have to take care of?
At first it was a shock, but it was something that I just sort of fell into. Like one morning I just woke up, I had all these brothers and sisters. I loved it. I mean, as a kid, that's one thing that I remember as a kid, the isolation. It was worse than the beatings. Like I would be in the car and I'd look out the window and I would see these kids going to school, getting off the school bus. I'd be like, wow, you know, I can't do that. So yeah, the kids probably, when the times got really dark in the Amish, the kids are what made it possible to go on. You know, they're so sweet and innocent, and, you know, they're not like, you know, adults and teenagers who are always trying to report on you and, you know, just gossiping and literally telling lies behind your back. I mean, it was just such a mess. But, you know, the kids, they were always there wanting to hold your hand, wanting to do fun stuff. So, I mean, yeah, the kids were, it was amazing. But initially, I remember there was this joke that everybody says, like, you're better behaved than our grandparents. I mean, because I had been raised so strict. I mean, there was no running around the house. There was no laughing. There was no
play.
No. I mean, it was probably stricter than the military. Yeah, it was. You do this and you sit there. You be quiet. You don't, you know, you raise your hand if you want to talk. So, you know, Amish kids, they do run around the house and laugh. And, you know, they get to be kids. And that's something that I never got to do. So when I got there, you know, I was very well behaved. I never thought of doing something I wasn't supposed to, other than not knowing how to follow all of the little rules and my stepdad sabotaging me. But, you know, other than that, they were shocked at how well behaved I was.
That definitely backfired on your stepdad, yeah, because he's thinking, oh, she won't fit in. And you're like, I'm a pro at this.
I'm going to go
following rules.
Yeah, no, I did. If they told me to do something, I did it. And I did it as fast as possible. And they were shocked. They said, you're a great worker. I mean, and that's like very high up there for Amish. You know, a woman, you know, to be considered a good wife, you know, wife material, like you're a good worker, you know, you can bring money into the house and take care of everything. That's what they want. So,
yeah. And you weren't allowed to live on your own. I thought that was an interesting detail. Yeah. You're like, I just want to live on my own because you're 19, but you're not allowed in the Amish community unless you're 50 and single.
Basically, once your childbearing years have passed, that's when they consider you able to live on your own. It's very rare. I know like two twin sisters, they have a bakery. They were living on their own when they were like 50, 55. You know, they just kind of had their own business. It's so sad. They said, you know, a 19-year-old girl living on her own, you know, you're just going to have guys coming in and out of your window. I mean, why would guys be coming in and out of your window in the first place? I mean, like, basically, they said you're going to be a prostitute. I mean, that's pretty much. Yeah, they said a girl cannot live on her own. Basically, you're not allowed to have your own money, you know. Until you're 21, the money goes to your dad. And then most girls are married by that age. So then the money goes to their husband. So you're a girl is not supposed to have any freedom, pretty much.
What age were you? As you mentioned in the book, you started making $3 a day. When did that kick in?
So when you turn 21, if you're not married yet, you're supposed to be married. But if you're not married yet, then because you're an adult, what they considered adult in the 1800s pretty much, they have to start giving you some form of payment. So your parents, if you're working for your parents, you're supposed to be treated like hired help. And in the strict Amish communities, hired help is given $3 a day. I think it was $3.15 a day or something. So when you turn 21, they start keeping a log and putting an envelope for you. You know, maybe once a month, they put your $3.15 a day in the envelope. And yeah, that's how much you make. And then when you do finally get married, you give that envelope to your husband.
So you are not even supposed to have it ever. It's not supposed to be your own money.
I mean, if you need a new dress, or I mean, they subtract money from there. If you need a dress, if you need if you go to the hospital, if, I mean, whatever you need as an adult, they no longer pay it for you. It comes out of there. So it's not like you're just saving that money away and living at home for free. Whatever you need, the money gets taken out of that envelope.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a moment where in your book, you're like, she gave me this envelope of money, and I'm like, what am I going to do with this? I'm like, oh, that's so wholesome. Like, that's the one thing you need to get out. You're not even registering. You're just like, well, this is for my husband, and I'm not married, so I guess we'll just stash it away, or should I save some of it?
Up until I left, I don't think I'd ever bought any. I didn't know how to use money. I'd never bought anything unless my mom sent me in to buy her a Coke or a pack of gum or – but yeah, I'd never, I barely knew how to use the phone. I actually learned how to use the phone in the Amish community by going to the neighbors. So I didn't know how to use money. You know, I didn't know that you needed an ID or social security card, or I was very, very naive about how the world worked. Yeah.
Right. They made you burn your social security card, right? Yeah. When you got there. Wow. So you had one. It was in your hands and then it was taken away.
Yeah. I had some few pictures and a social security card. And I mean, I didn't realize how valuable it was, or maybe I would have never shown it to them.
But, right.
They asked me, you know, they actually saw the pictures. So they told me to burn it. And I just did it. I mean, that sounds crazy, but.
But you didn't know.
I didn't realize the value. I mean, I didn't realize that I even needed it.
What you need it for. Let's talk a little bit about the first home you were in and some of the tension, because I think that also lends itself to the atmosphere of over-sexualizing women, or being suspicious of women, or how you had to make yourself small to not be seen in a certain type of light.
For young, unmarried Amish girls, you're supposed to not bring any attention to yourself. The boy seeks you out if he wants you. He asks you, you know, if he can take you home or whatever. But you are not supposed to ever bring any attention on yourself. And even if you try not to bring attention on yourself, if you get unwanted attention and it's noticed, you are blamed. So there's this idea, you know, that Eve made Adam eat the apple, or offered him the apple. So the woman is the temptress, and she's constantly tempting men, wanting to tempt men. So if you seem outgoing, if you seem happy, if you're smiling, I mean, anything can be construed as tempting a man. And if he starts giving you attention, then it's your fault. So that's what happened to me, like right from the beginning. You know, I was accused of all kinds of things because I was different, and men were in the community. They were looking at me, you know, not because I was gorgeous or anything. I was different. Everybody was looking at me. I mean, the women too. I mean, she's different. She's not one of us. She's, you know, who knows what her history is. I mean, she's just different. She doesn't act like us. And of course, I acted different than other people. I had different, you know, things I did differently. The boys would look at me at the singing. My Amish dad started paying a little bit too much attention to me and ignoring his wife. And then his wife got, you know, of course, jealous because he didn't treat her very nice. Mm. So he would ignore her and talk to me, which he shouldn't have done. And as much as I tried to, you know, I wore my dress. I pinned it as loose as possible. I completely covered my hair with my head covering. You know, I did all of these things to try and stop this attention. But the more I did it, it seemed like the more attention I got.
and I just couldn't get away from it. And my Amish mom, she just, she treated me really terrible because she was jealous. And, you know, I understand it more, you know, now that I'm married, you know, why she had that reaction. But to me at the time, it just seemed impossible. I couldn't live under that. She was constantly accusing me of stuff I didn't do. She was yelling at me, you know, it was just, it was suffocating. And my Amish dad, he wouldn't stop. You know, I think he was doing it on purpose to make her upset. Mm-hmm. You know, sitting and talking to me in the evening about whatever. So finally, the bishop of our church, he said, you know, my wife is sick all the time. I was really good friends with his wife. And he said, you know, just come live with us as a maid for maybe a year and let things die down at home. And, you know, because we need help. So I was like, okay, you know, I got to get out of here. I just seemed like I kept having to get out of all of these situations. And I was like, okay, I'll get out of here. I'll go help them. I'll be their maid. I'll take care of the kids. And, you know, things will be better. But I knew that there was something off about the bishop. I'd been warned about him. And when I was carrying my stuff out of the house, my Amish dad, he actually stopped me in the doorway. He's like, you cannot move into that house. He's a bad man. He's a really bad man.
Wow.
But because of the Amish rules, he was not allowed to tell me
why.
Bad how.
Yeah.
Because when you're forgiven in the Amish church, you're not allowed to name that person's sin, or you can actually get in trouble. So he would just say he's a bad man. And I was like, you know, I thought he was a bad man. I mean, he treated his wife terribly. So I was like, okay.
So I'll take my chances.
Yeah. That's what I thought, you know, and I'd grown up with abuse. So, you know, I thought I can take it. I mean, that's really sad that you grow up in that sort of situation. And then, I mean, it happened to me. I was like, I can take it. I mean, he's touchy feely or whatever. I can take it. I can handle it. You know, nobody should ever think that. But, you know, so many kids that grow up in abusive situations, they actually do think that, you know, it's not that bad. I can handle it.
Yeah.
No need to make waves. But yeah, that's what I thought. I thought I can handle it. And I couldn't at the end.
Yeah. It was more than you ever anticipated.
Yeah, it was way worse. You know, I just heard, you know, that he was touchy-feely. That's what I thought the issue was. And everybody seemed to know it. But yeah, it was way worse than that.
Especially when, and maybe we'll get to this a little bit later about when your book came out, what you actually found out about him. Yeah. So maybe I'll save that. But initially, it seemed like things were well because you had your own little space that you were able to be alone in. I was rooting for you. I was like, yeah, this seems like it's going to go so well. And you're helping with the kids and you're enjoying yourself. And that's when everything kind of spiraled out. And I think the book was teasing this dread that you had been feeling and you didn't really know where it was coming from until finally it all came to a head and everything came out that it was your worst nightmare. And yeah. I'm just so sorry that you had to go through that.
Yeah. Well, just to think back to it, it's like a different person. Like a different person went through that I know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it seems like. But yeah, before I had moved into the bishop's house, I started learning what the Amish practices are when it comes to abuse. Mm. And it was alarming to me because I was taught that if you were not Amish, you were going to go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I thought there were so many things in the Amish that I didn't agree with, but I can't believe that. But I thought, I mean, I just have to do this because if I'm not Amish, I will go to hell. And mm-hmm. I want to be a good person. I want to go to heaven, you know, all of that. So it just seems bizarre. But I mean, I truly, truly believe that if you left the Amish, you were going to hell 100%. That's it.
Yeah.
So I started learning these things that were really, really bothering me because it didn't fit with my idea of, you know, wanting to be a good person, lead a good life, do good things and go to heaven.
Yeah.
So first I learned about this 14-year-old girl in our community that had been abused by an outsider that lived on the property. And she was blamed for it. She was 14. They said she was too outgoing. So she became messed up because of that. She was blamed. She was constantly watched. And this guy was actually a known human trafficker. He was later
convicted for human trafficking. So this was a bad guy. So I learned about that situation first. And I was like, this poor girl, she was my friend. She was like 2 years younger than me. But she was always self-conscious, always afraid that she was doing something wrong and she was going to be attacked again. I mean, that's what it seemed like. And then I learned that the bishop's wife, she confided in me that her dad was a deacon in the church and he had molested her and all of her sisters. And one sister actually had a child with him. I mean, it's they pretty much know that it's his kid. So I was like, you know, I asked her, like, why didn't somebody do something? You know, why? And she's like, well, my mom, she went to the, you know, she went to the ministers over and over at least 5 times and reported him and he was put in the ban. But, you know, he continued to do it while he was in the ban. I mean, ban is just you don't get to go to church, which is a vacation for most people. You know, they don't want to sit in church for 3 hours anyway. So that you don't get to go to church. You don't have to go to, like, community gatherings. I mean, the ban is like a vacation. So it did nothing. And she did it 5 times, and then she finally gave up. And I asked her, you know, why didn't you go to the police? Why, you know, why didn't you do something? You know, I had some idea that there was police there that would arrest people for doing bad things. And she said, no, that's not our way. You know, we can get in the ban ourselves if we go to the police. You know, that's not the Amish way. We're not supposed to contact outside authorities. So this, her dad actually came and visited the community and stayed at her house. And she had children the age that he liked. And I remember thinking to myself, this is just insane. Mm-hmm. Probably because I hadn't grown up with that idea. You know, I'd grown up with a psycho stepdad and a sadistic mother, but I hadn't grown up with the idea that the entire community was like in on the plot.
Right.
I mean, to me,
everyone knew about it.
Yeah. I mean, it was well-known knowledge. He was still a deacon. I mean, once you're a bishop or a deacon or minister, that position can't be taken away from you because it's chosen by lot and it's supposedly God chose you. So it's never taken away from you. And I just thought this was just bizarre. I mean, really, I couldn't believe it. And she was worried. I mean, she was crying to me. She's like, my daughter, Katie, she's the age, you know, that he started molesting me. And I was like, he's sleeping in her house.
Yeah.
So I knew this when I went into the bishop's house. And yeah, then things started happening. And I think that former knowledge is what kind of made me say, you know, wait a minute. Something is not right here. And like a light bulb went off for me, I guess. And I realized, I mean, people are telling me this stuff, but it doesn't make it right. Just because they say so doesn't make it right. You know, I have to do what I feel is right because at the end of the day, I have to live with myself.
Yeah. So. I'm sure that was terrifying too, knowing that if you did report him to someone else in the community, that you would be blamed.
Yeah. When I moved into the house, like you said, I had like my own little room off to the side. I mean, it's the first time I ever had my own anything. And it was so exciting for me. It was like I'd been asking to live alone all these years, and it kind of was like I was getting to do that. Mm-hmm. And the bishop was okay with it, which I was surprised. It was like it was a bakery that was built at the side of the house, so it was like my own little house. It had a door to the outside. I mean, he had ulterior motives, that's why he was okay with it. But I set my stuff up in there. My Amish mom, she gave me the envelope with my money in it. I don't know why I decided to take some of it out and hide it in my hope chest. I mean, I had no plans of leaving. I remember I just felt this sense of doom. Like I just had, it started when I got in the community and it just got worse and worse and worse. And I didn't know what it was. I mean, I don't know if it was a premonition of something to, I mean, I just had this sense of dread, like something bad was going to happen. So I did. I hid some of the money in my hope chest and my clock. Like, I just like knowing it was there. I didn't know how to use it, but I like knowing it was there. So I moved in there. The bishop's wife, she had seizures like every other day. She was very sick. They had 7 children, ages, I think it was 11 to baby. So there was so much work to do. And when I moved into their house, she seemed to get sicker and sicker. And I'm positive, you know, the bishop was giving her something. He was giving her these herbs, and I was doing exorcisms on her and hitting her with the Bible. And just while she was like rolling around with a seizure, it was so horrible. But yeah, she just got sicker and sicker, and I became like the mom for the children. And the bishop actually said one day at breakfast, you know, the mom was in bed sick, and he's like to the children, you know, Misty would make a, or, you know, my Amish name, she would make a great mom if anything happened to your mom, right? And the kids were like, oh, yeah, yeah, she'd be great. She's fun. And I was like, what?
Oh.
Why would you say such a thing?
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, yeah, he started sexually abusing me right from the, I guess, the second day I was there. It just started out slow, like coming up behind me and touching me, pretending that it was an accident at first. Mm-hmm. I think to sort of gauge
your reactions.
My reaction, which was startled. I mean, but I was kind of expecting it. You know, he started doing it right in front of the family. It was so, I've heard that from so many other people, though. Like, it's something they sort of get off on, some of, you know, some sexual predators. He would come up behind me and he would touch me and see if I would make a reaction in front of, you know, the kids or his wife or, yeah, it happened multiple times a day. But I was quiet. I mean, he was the bishop. Who was I going to tell?
Right.
The minister, the deacon. And if I did, the first reaction was going to be, what are you doing to cause it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing anything. I'm washing the dishes. I mean, what could I possibly be doing when I'm washing the dishes?
Yeah.
Or making lunch or, you know, whatever. But, you know, what's the point of reporting something when that's going to be their very first reaction? And the reaction is going to be to tell the entire church that it happened, you know, everybody 17 and over is baptized. So they sit in on these church meetings. So all of the young folks are going to know, you know, everybody in your peer group is going to know. So it's better to be quiet. Mm-hmm. So I put up with it. It got worse. You know, he was exposing himself. And he was laughing. He was doing it for kicks. He was having a great time, and I think he realized that I was never going to say anything because I was afraid.
Yeah.
And that's what they count on. So finally, after I'd been there for about 6 months, I went down in the basement one day, and I caught him with his daughter, his 12-year-old daughter, and he was pinning up her dress. You know, the Amish have the pins that go down the front. When you're 11, you start wearing the pin-up dress. So her dress was unpinned and he was pinning. He was frantically. He had them in his hand. He was frantically, because he heard me coming down the stairs, you know, the wood stairs. He was frantically trying to pin it, and he got about halfway, and then he turned and saw me, and his face was just beet red. And she was like this, and he just like shoved the pins at her and he ran out the basement door. And I think she didn't know how to react. So she just like ran up the stairs past me and she pretended like nothing happened.
Yeah.
And I was just like standing there. I was like, okay, I see what's going on here. And it's not just me.
Yeah.
It's the kids. And his wife, you know, she grew up this way. I mean, and there's other people. I knew other people in the community grew up this way. I like, this has got to stop. But I couldn't go to the police or I was going to get in trouble. And how would I get to the police in the first place? I mean, we were 6 miles out of town again. We didn't have a phone, you know. Even if I wanted to write them a letter, all of your mail, everybody goes through your mail. A single person cannot just send a letter. Whatever house you're living in, you have to show either your parents, your house parents. I mean, I would have had to show the bishop my mail before I sent it out. Everything is censored when you're unmarried. Since I've left, I've had people that have thought about trying to sneak a, you know, letter in the mailbox. But if you get caught, you know, or they count stamps, if a stamp is missing, you know, how are you going to contact the police?
Wow. I didn't realize it was that controlled.
You're going to take the buggy and try to get down the road? I mean, they're going to get on a horse and catch you before you get anywhere.
And luckily you had these neighbors who were renting a plot of land, right, for horses.
Yeah, we had these people living on the property that had like this equine rescue. So I'd become pretty good friends with her. And one morning the bishop came in my little apartment-like place and he savagely assaulted me. Like I cannot remember. There's a lot of things that I can't remember about it. It was so severe.
from there, I ran to this neighbor's. I mean, he actually caught me when I came out the door. He actually caught me. He was waiting at the door to see if I would do that, I think. And when I did, he caught me, but I got away from him. And I went down to these neighbors and I told her what happened. And she was actually a sexual assault survivor herself.
Wow. And yeah. Non-Amish, just to clarify.
No Amish. She wore like a little scarf on her head, trying to blend in, but she wasn't Amish. And she actually told me, she's like, you got to go to the police. You got to report this. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is serious. I think at that time I could remember better what happened. But as the day progressed, I kept losing my memory of what had happened. It was really horrific. So she actually put me in her truck and drove me to the police. And the bishop was standing there, like when we were driving out the lane, and he was smiling. It was so.
What?
Yeah, I think he knew that nothing. I mean, there's this cockiness of, you know, I'm untouchable.
And he essentially was at that point.
Yeah. I mean, and the scary thing was that he knew it.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't that he was scared and then they came out and didn't do anything. And I was like, oh, no, he was smiling at us when we drove out. It was so strange. Yeah, I thought that was weird. But basically, I went in. I told my story to the police. I had this Amish coat on, this, you know, denim coat with hook and eyes. It was March, so it was cold. And, you know, the police were just very hesitant to do anything. They were very hesitant about my story. And, you know, underneath this coat, I had my breast. They had handprints on them. My dress was torn.
Mm.
But nobody bothered to take pictures, to check me out, to do anything. They actually just let me go. I had nowhere to go. So they let me go back to that property. And they had my statement, and they actually sort of begrudgingly came out to talk to him. And it's like he was waiting for them. He was in the house. He opened the door. He's like, hi, you know, all the kids there, you know, looks very cute. White house, you know, Amish kids. And he brings them in. I'm guessing they had tea or something. I mean, they were in there for, I don't know, 45 minutes or so. And then they came out and the police are waving goodbye.
Oh, so frustrating.
Yeah.
And it's because they had this picture-perfect idea of who the Amish were. They didn't think by any means that something could happen like that in the community. So they just brushed it off.
I think that they didn't want to think anything like that could happen. And if it did, they didn't care. I mean, there's this idea that so many people have had that I've talked to since that were Amish. They tried to go to the police. And the police say the Amish take care of their own. They have their own ways. They punish their own. It's allowed. I mean, it's known and it's allowed, and it's just, it's like the Amish are a sovereign nation and they can do whatever they want, but they're not. They're not a sovereign nation.
Right.
But that's like the view.
Wow. I'm sure at that point you were just so beside yourself. You've just gone through this horrific abuse. You've gone from one situation to another. You're finally escaping out. You finally get the nerve to go and get help, and they just brush you off.
The only reason that I went to it's so sad. Like, I couldn't go to the police for myself, but the children, I was like, it clicked. Oh my goodness, the children. Oh my goodness, there's 7 children in this house. I mean, I'd heard stories of babies being raped. I mean, it's just I was freaking out. I think the one thing that helped me, I got angry. I was like, what? No, this is not right. I don't care what you say. I don't care what you say. This is wrong. There are children in this house.
Mm-hmm.
I was a child. Nobody helped me. They cannot help themselves. Their community's not going to help them. Who's going to help them? So this lady that lived on the property, she had weird internet workup going on where she could make phone calls. And I started bugging the police station, like, what are you going to do? You know, blah, 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 blah. And they wouldn't do anything. So eventually this lady, she agreed to drive me to my step aunt that lived in Western Washington over by Seattle. And she was nice. I remembered her as being nice, very nice lady. She had a furniture shop. And this lady that I was staying with, she Googled it. She found her furniture shop, her phone number, called her. And my step aunt was like, yeah, of course. You know, she can come here, stay here with me. Eventually, after, you know, a few weeks, I left the property. I just left the Amish. And I put on different clothes, skirts and a scarf, and I was out of there. But I kept bugging the police station because of the kids. You know, I was mm-hmm. like, I never expected, you know, anything to happen with me or, you know, my case. I didn't really care about that. I cared about the kids. Mm-hmm. And about 2 weeks after I left the Amish, I called the detective again, and he was like, they're gone. They're gone. They've left the property. They're all gone. The entire family's gone. We asked what happened. They asked around, and they said that the bishop hired a van. He loaded the entire family in the van. He took all of the money from the church purse, and they went to Canada. They're gone. They said that somebody that had talked to him started to get suspicious, started to think back on the situation. He was like, thinking the wife, you know, looked a little bit jumpy. You know, there's maybe some things that were amiss. And they were actually going to go out and question him again. And that's when they discovered they were gone. Mm. And he said, this kind of reaction, it makes us think that when he had lived in Wisconsin, maybe there's something that happened back there that he doesn't want us to find out about or he's scared of.
So he fled and took the church's money. So it wasn't like they let him go. It was very clear that he fled.
He didn't ask. I think he just took it. It was in his house. So he took his money. They left all of their farm equipment. They left the farm. They left the animal. They left. They
like just deserted it.
Fled. Yeah. Completely just got up and ran.
And I'm sure the police at that point were realizing, oh, there might be something to this.
Yeah. That's what they told me. They said that they had always believed my story, but now they were starting to think that maybe there was something else that I didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And the problem is when, you know, like I said, when you're shunned and you're taken back into the church, nobody's allowed to talk about what you did. So my community might not have even known what he did in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. if he did something in Wisconsin when he lived there.
One of the things that you talked about in your book is that once they're forgiven, they just go right back into the family, into the place where their victims are. And so they can just continue to reoffend and no one can say anything about it.
I mean, that's the thing. Usually the children that are sexually abused, they are abused by either their father or their brother that's in the house. I mean, that's
the most common.
95% of the cases that I've heard, that's the most common. Mm. So if somebody does get the courage to bring it up to the church, then the church is like, okay, you're shunned for 6 weeks. Okay, do you accept your punishment? Sure. I mean, it's just like to satisfy everybody that, you know, we've done something, but the children are not taken out of the home. They are not, you know, are you okay? You know, do you need, is just shut up.
Yeah.
Everybody go about as normal. You know, he's been punished. And, you know, like the bishop's wife said, he never stopped while he was in the band. I mean, well, It's for show, pretty much.
So while you're in the band, you don't have to leave the house.
You're not allowed to do anything social. I mean, you can go to church, but you have to sit like on a chair on the side. Most people don't go to church. You don't have to go to like barn raisings or quiltings or, you know, any social events. I mean, it's kind of like a vacation because most people, they get tired of doing all that stuff anyway. You're just required to do it. In the home, you have to eat at a separate table than baptized members. So if it's just your wife that's baptized and the kids aren't old enough to be baptized yet, then you have to like sit at the side in your own little table.
So you're basically around kids more when you're put in the van. Like you're at home more than you would have been.
Yeah, you're kind of just in the home and on the farm and nobody can see what you're doing. I mean, it's just when it started, you know, it wasn't set up for this kind of thing. It was the band was like, you know, did you tell a lie? Did you commit fornication? You know, I don't think this child abuse was even thought of. I mean, they're not set up to deal with that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So let's talk about your mentality after you left the Amish, because I know it was a huge transition. Now you're really in the outside world from one isolation to another to the outside world. I'm sure it was a huge shock. And you were older, 22 at this point.
Yeah. 22.
So what's going through your mind? What are some of the adjustments that you're having to make and having to figure out?
I mean, it was terrifying because I felt like I was in a different planet.
Yeah.
I mean, the refrigerator annoyed me. I remember electric lights annoyed me. I mean, I was annoyed by a lot of things. I could hear the refrigerator humming. I remember that. So in my bedroom, I could hear the refrigerator humming.
What?
Yeah. The TV, like the TV hurt my eyes. And of course, I acted different. You know, you're in the Amish, you're taught to keep your head down, look at the ground. And my step aunt was like, why don't you look at people when you're talking to them? Like there's something wrong with me. I mean, she had an adjustment too, because I would tell her all of these bizarre things and she was like, what?
Uh-huh.
I mean, she had been, you know, grown up in the outside world. She was popular in high school. She had all of her friends from high school still. I mean, she was just this popular lady in the community that everybody loved. And the stuff that I told her, she was like, I'm not understanding. So, yeah, but she helped me a lot. You know, she helped me adjust and... I was like, you got to start wearing deodorant.
Deodorant. That's so funny.
You should shave your legs. It would look so much nicer if you shaved your pretty legs. And she said things so nice. But
oh, yeah. That's so sweet that she was gentle about it.
Yeah.
Just the simple things, too. You mentioned about taking a shower every day. We're like, oh, a hot shower. Because in the Amish, you could take a bath once a week. And you had one pair of clothes like for the week.
An inch and a half of water.
Oh, geez.
And the soap was for decoration. Like, it was there, but you shouldn't use it.
Why weren't you allowed to use soap?
It was just expensive.
Oh. I don't know what I would do without showers. I was just telling Jonathan, my husband, 2 days ago. I was like, oh, what would I do without this hot shower every morning?
It's just that was so probably relaxing. That was probably my most favorite discovery.
Yeah.
For a long time. And running water, hot running water to do the dishes.
Yeah.
I hated the hair dryer. So.
Really?
It was so... I hated anything that made noise. Like, it really bothered me. Like, I couldn't hear anything when I was drying my hair, so I was constantly looking around. Oh, there was so many things that were just... I don't know. Even now, I do stuff that my husband's like, what are you doing?
Wait, like what?
Like, you should turn the lights on. It's dark in here. I was like, we don't need light. Like, you weren't supposed to turn on the lamps until you literally could not see anymore because you were wasting oil.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm still walking around the house when it's dark.
Yeah, and even the clothes you mentioned were a huge transition, how you wanted to cover your head for a long time. What was that like?
My head felt naked. Like I didn't necessarily believe that I needed to wear it. My head felt so naked. I wore dresses and skirts for probably a little more than a year. And then I got the baggiest pants I could possibly find at JCPenney's. Like some girls that I was staying with, they took me shopping. And they got me like the baggiest pants. And I was like, I feel naked. I feel so naked.
Oh,
like,
my with these, gosh.
I mean, I remember the pants. They were just, like, ridiculous looking. They're like, no, you look great. You look great. And they were, like, trying to fix my hair. And I don't think I transitioned as quickly as some just because I'd been so isolated. You know, I didn't grow up wishing that I could wear this dress or, you know, that shoes or – like, a lot of Amish kids, they have catalogs and they're, you know, they see neighbors all the time and – I didn't grow up with that. So the clothes, how I looked and stuff wasn't a big, that's not why I left the Amish.
Yeah. It seemed like you really took in the doctrine as well when you moved in. You were very much, okay, these are the rules. I'm going to go to heaven. And it makes sense to me, especially with your childhood, because it gave you something hopeful and it gave you something to latch on to and to do well. And you did do it well. And so I imagine it took a long time to deconstruct that thought process.
By the time I'd left, I'd actually sort of forgot how to speak English. I was mixing German and English together because it was so ingrained in my head that English was bad. Every time I spoke English, they would get on to me because you're not allowed to speak English in the home, only to outsiders. Mm. So it caused some sort of trauma, and I sort of had to relearn how to speak English, I jumped in the Amish like, I'm going to be the best Amish person that there's possibly can be. And I just tried my hardest. The children, finding out the children were being abused, that kind of dissolved everything. And I was like, wait a minute. I was that child and nobody helped me.
Yeah.
I can't be that person. That was my thought. I mean, I could never live with myself. I always thought in the back of my head, I was like, how am I going to be a 45-year-old married Amish woman sitting on the bench seeing these guys being forgiven for the 100th time for abusing their kids, how am I going to live with myself? Mm. I mean, that was always a thought in my head. It was like, I'm not going to be able to live with that. I mean, it was like something that was slowly building up within me. I was like, I can't do that. I can't be the person that looks away, you know, because I was that kid and I really, really needed help and nobody helped me. How can I be the person that doesn't help them?
Yeah. And that's really big of you to put that ahead of everything else. I mean, just leaving and trying to get a social security number, realizing you can't even get on a plane without a driver's license. And it's like, no, there's so many obstacles. Or trying to get your GED with a third grade education. I mean, anything you put your mind to, you eventually did it. And that's amazing. I think you were in this survival mode, but also just wanting to build something for yourself. And throughout your whole book, you talked about wanting to become a doctor and be a missionary in a different country. And so I was rooting for that. I'm like, you can do it. But there was just obstacle after obstacle. And so I think your good nature eventually won and took over and helped you achieve everything. And now you're in nursing school. I'm jumping ahead. you're getting a master's in nursing. I should correct myself. So when you got out and you got your GED, which was a huge accomplishment, everyone was like, I don't know, is she going to be able to do it in 4 months and study? And you did. Mm-hmm. Then you went to become a missionary. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I just, I don't know. When I was a kid, I like was looking at National Geographic and I just like, I want to go, I want to help people. That's something I always wanted to do from the time I was little. I wanted to help people. So when I left the Amish, I got my GED, like you said, and I went to YWAM, Youth of the Mission. It's like a missionary school. It just, you know, sends people overseas for a few months. So, yeah, I did that. It was a great experience. I met my husband. We got married like a few months after we got back. Yeah, and life just started. I mean, it just took off, you know. You have to work. You have to pay the bills. You have to. Yeah, I learned how to use money very quickly. I learned it was very useful. So yeah, I started working, going to school, community college, you know. My history teacher tried to get me to be a history teacher because my essays, she loved my essays. And she's like, you're really great at writing. She like encouraged me. Like she planted the seed. Her and my English teacher, they planted the seed that, you know, you can really write. You know, and I eventually did write. And I really loved college and going to nursing school and then I had a baby and now I'm doing my master's.
That's amazing.
I'm so busy.
Yeah. Honestly,
time flies by. Like when you're busy, it just flies by.
Yeah. I love that you went back and included in the book how you wrote the book and how the book eventually affected so many things. We're listening to it in the car, Jonathan and I, and he's like, so meta. He's like, I love how we're getting to see an insider within her book that's, you know, it's a cool thing that you added. So let's talk about that, how the book actually affected so many.
I guess it was 7 years after I left the Amish. There was like a big child abuse case, the Gabriel Fernandez case that, was all over the news, you know, here where I live in Los Angeles. So I was just like, my gosh, you know, who is ever going to look out for kids? I mean, it just seems like kids are, I mean, this had nothing to do with religion. It just seems like kids at every turn are let down. If they don't have good parents, you know, a good family structure, they are like just left to the wolves. Mm-hmm. I mean, the social workers let this kid down. Just the police, I mean, everybody, they let this kid down and he died from being tortured. I mean, he was tortured by his mom and his stepdad. So that really, I don't know, I just sat down one day and I started writing. I was like, somebody has got to raise awareness about child abuse and child abuse in religious communities. That mm-hmm. is something that never sees the light of day. It will not get splashed all over the news. I mean, it's very rare that it does. So yeah, that just fueled me to sit down and start writing. I was writing as fast as I can. My husband was like, he's like, you got to make it at least 100 pages. Do you think you can get to 100 pages?
Little did he know.
Before I knew it, I was at 700 pages, which had to be eventually edited down. But yeah, I just started pouring my story out and I was like, if, you know, just one person reads this and, you know, it's like, I can go to college too and, you know, I can do stuff too. It would be worth it. So
Yeah, I didn't expect it to become popular. I just uploaded it on Amazon, self-published on Amazon. I didn't even have an Amazon account. I made the account and then I forgot my password. And I uploaded it. And then a week later, I like checked on it and it was taking off in the UK. And then it started taking off in the US. I mean, it sold about 500,000 Kindle copies already.
Oh my gosh.
About 2 years after I wrote it, I was so excited, you know, that little nobody me was having this success with this book. I put my email in there, so I was getting all these emails from people, you know, this religious group, that religious group, this non-religious, you know, family, whatever. And, you know, it's like child abuse is just something that we need to put a lot more attention on. I mean, mm-hmm. this is not okay. If this was an adult, I mean, it would be on every headline anywhere. I mean, just because it's a child, it's not okay.
Right.
So yeah, I helped in some like real life child abuse cases. I had a 13-year-old contact me for help and I was able to, you know, guide her to her principal and her teacher. They called in CPS. I mean, it was great. And out of the blue one day, I get a message from somebody that knows, she says she knows the bishop's children. I was like, what? I mean, I'd been out of the Amish for, I think it was 10 years by then, 10 or 11 years. Yeah. I was leery. So I sent my email and yeah, but it was the bishop's children. The oldest daughter, she called me and she was like, yeah, we just reported our dad. He molested all the children, almost all the children. He was molesting us while you were in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told that we had to go to Canada because you were this evil lady and you were trying to take our dad away from us and all of us kids were going to be split up and put into foster care.
Oh.
So we had to leave and go to Canada. So they were there for like a couple years and then they were given the option to either be deported back to the US or leave. I never quite got how Canada became aware of them, but they were given that option. So they had to come back to the United States. And after a few years, the oldest three daughters, they asked a neighbor for help because they had a baby sister and they're like, we got to save this last one. So they told the neighbor lady, she contacted CPS, CPS contacted law enforcement. And it just so happens that when they contacted law enforcement, the detective that was called in was reading my book.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's so odd. And he was like, he started questioning one of the younger daughters that I hadn't had any contact with. And, started questioning her and she started saying all this stuff. You know, we went to Canada when I was, before I was born. And then it's like, wait a minute. And where did you live? And then he asked the kids, did you ever have a maid named Emma? And he started putting all the pieces. He's like, oh my gosh, wow. These are the people from this story.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. And then he gave it to the social worker. The social worker gave it to the kids. That's how they contacted me. But, yeah, he was finally sentenced to prison, only 10 years. But it came out that he had molested almost all the kids.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the oldest daughter, she got custody of all of the kids under 18. And the mom lost her parental rights because she knew and she didn't save the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
The impact. So crazy. That yeah. full circle. How did you feel like you were able to get justice with that whole situation?
For me, that was enough. You know, it was so sad. I mean, it made me so upset. I was like, if only the police had listened to me. I mean, yeah. there was children that had not even been born yet that were molested.
Mm-hmm.
And they were raised in this weird isolation, sort of similar to what I was, because he was so afraid of the police. They lived on the outskirts of the Amish community. And, you know, they tried not to make, you know, too much of a scene. Or, you know, they didn't want to do anything to attract law enforcement because he was so afraid of being arrested. So they had to suffer so much growing up. I mean, the oldest daughter, she was suicidal and just really, a lot of the kids were really in a bad place. And I was like, if they had just listened to me. But in the end, at least, you know, he went to prison. He's a registered sex offender. I mean, at least it came out that, you know, he was a bad guy. The children were able to get away from him. I mean, by that time, the oldest daughter was 21 years old, I think, 21 or 22.
Mm-hmm.
And she was still at home, still trying to protect these kids. She said she spent her entire life trying to protect the other kids. She would, like, follow her dad around if she saw him leading, like, one of the girls off or saw him in the bedroom. And she always felt so hated by her dad because she was doing that. I mean, at least at the end,
he was held accountable. And as far as they know, they saved the last 3-year-old baby.
Mm.
But he abused the boys. He abused the girls.
That's so awful.
Just really, really sad.
Wow.
Yeah, I read some of the reports. It would make you want to vomit.
Yeah. And knowing that your book made such an impact and eventually created Sins of the Amish, it's so amazing. Like we mentioned in the beginning of this, which is everyone is being... The wool is being pulled off of everyone's eyes as far as no longer romanticizing the Amish. I have so many people in the comments that are like, I will never see them the same way again. And that's not to say that everyone who is an Amish person is bad. Of course not. It's systems, not people. It's the systems that create these systemic problems and these patterns. So having had all that experience and hearing people's stories who have written into you, what are some of the main things, the takeaways that you would want to talk about? Why this continues to happen and why abuse is so prevalent in these communities?
So, I mean, it's not just the Amish. Like, there are so many different religious groups, and not just Christian.
Yeah.
I'm talking about strict religions,
mm-hmm.
that they have this control over their people. They usually enforce a dress code, a way of lifestyle. I mean, like, look at the Amish. They dress in uniform. Do you know anybody that would love to dress in uniform every single minute of their lives? No. It's enforced so strictly. There is so much control and so much talk about you're going to go to hell if you step over this line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that keeps people in check. So, I mean, it's not like there's one guy at the top of the Amish that's controlling everybody. It's a system that they have created since the 1600s that's sort of locking everybody in. They can't get out of it. They're locking themselves in. They keep creating different communities, and they're just enmeshed in these rules. And they, honest to goodness, they believe this. They believe, I was there. I believed it too, that if they leave the Amish, that they're going to go to hell. So they follow these rules. They do, you know, if the bishop says you don't go to the police, you don't go to the police. Whatever the bishop says goes. So, of course, onto all of the rules that they've created over these hundreds of years, they have added, don't go to the police. Don't go to the outside authorities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're separatist. We're not of this world. We're of heaven. You know, we don't have anything to do with law enforcement here. We don't, you know, we're not even citizens. They don't consider themselves citizens of the United States. So anytime you have that separatist us versus them, you're going to create this culture that deals with things internally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in any patriarchal society, usually, you know, sexual abuse, domestic violence, you know, those things are handled very lightly, if at all, because the men are in charge.
And, right.
You know, not to say that women are not also, you know, they don't abuse children too. They do. But usually at a much higher rate, it's men, and they set the rules. And of course, when, you know, your uncle, your best friend, and your cousin are child molesters, you're not going to want the police coming in there.
Mm-hmm.
So they've created this, don't go to the police. And if somebody does, then you're shunned. And the outside world, they see the Amish, they don't cause problems. You know, we don't see them coming in and out of the police station. We don't see them, you know, getting arrested for all this stuff because they handle everything internally. So the outside world views them as these pretty much saints. I mean, there's these great people. There's no crime. I mean, that's what people think. There's no crime in their community. You know, if we could just all be Amish, the world would be a fantastic place. So there's like this idealization.
Yeah.
And then you have the Amish romance novels. I mean, there's thousands of them. And they paint this perfect, I mean, literally
wholesome.
Perfect, wholesome lifestyle that is not in any way true. I mean, they don't talk about the rules. You know, a girl is wearing the wrong color dress and the deacon shows up on her doorstep. I mean, that's something that's never addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that. And then you have Lancaster County, the tourism. I mean, that mm-hmm. is a big business. And they would never want anything bad to come out about the Amish. So, and then you have law enforcement in the area. You know, they don't, when it comes to freedom of religion, it's something that law enforcement don't seem to be very well trained. Like, where's the line? I mean, when I went to the police, they told me, they're like, we have to be very careful not to trample on, you know, the freedom of this community, you know, their freedom of religion. We have to be very careful about that. And they told me that at least 3 times, me, the person begging them for help, they were like repeating it to themselves. Like, Like, what does that have to do with anything?
Yeah.
I mean, there seems to be a fear to get involved in a religion and to be seen as persecuting a religion. And that's something that really needs to be addressed, because the religions, they know this. The Amish know full well that the police do not want to come in there. I mean, if the FBI ever did a raid on the Amish for child abuse, they would be so overwhelmed. I mean, like they were with the, where was that, that they did the raid on the Mormons?
The FLDS in Texas.
Where they had all of these, they were just overwhelmed by all of these children. That, you know, they eventually sent them back to the compound. Literally, what are you going to do in a situation like that? I mean, you're going to be so overwhelmed by it.
So what do you think the answer would be as far as how do we help these kids who can't help themselves?
I think, first of all, you need to train the children. I mean, if you go somewhere and you see they have no food and they're capable of planting food, I mean, why would you bring food to them if you could teach them how to plant it and grow themselves? I mean, the only way that you're ever going to stop the tide of child sexual abuse is to tell the children, if this happens to you, if, you know, if this is done to you, in an age-appropriate way, you know, not just graphic.
Of course.
Inform the child. There are people that will listen to you. They want to help you. You do not have to put up with this. I mean, this is wrong. This is not healthy. Mm-hmm. You need to tell the children this, and then they will know. I didn't know. I had no idea that anybody would even care about me as a kid. So the only way to help this is, I think that there needs to be age-appropriate child sexual abuse prevention education in every school, and no religious exemption. In every school, including religious schools, you know, they need to have, the teachers need to be mandated reporters, and they need to be held accountable to report abuse. And, you know, my husband was like, every school is like that. Every teacher is a mandated reporter. I'm like, no.
It varies state to state, doesn't it?
The Amish, they are not mandated reporters. If you're not licensed, you're not a mandated reporter. So the Amish, basically it's a teenage girl who's teaching school. She doesn't ever report anything. You know, the Mennonites, they're unlicensed. I know some Scientologist schools are unlicensed. Homeschooling, they're not licensed. You know, they're not held accountable to report child abuse. There's so many situations where when it comes to religion, it's so easy to hide the kids and just separate them from any sort of resource that could help them. And the kids, they just grow up in these situations. They don't know there's help. And if there's help, they don't know who to ask it. You know, who's going to help me?
Yeah.
You know, my church isn't going to help me. They're gonna stamp this down and cover it up and make me be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of kids grow up knowing that. And they grow up that whatever your parents tell you to do or your elders tell you to do, you're supposed to do it. So the only way to try and get a handle on this is to teach the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Teach the kids and make it mandatory. No religious exception. There should be no exception to trying to stamp out child sex abuse.
Yeah.
Why would there be an exception?
There's a lot of people who've been in our comments, and I want to get your opinion on this, who say, oh, I'll never support the Amish again, or I used to go and buy goods from them and now I won't. Is that actually helpful? Because I know it's not everybody in the Amish who has problematic things going on. So what would you say to that as far as supporting by buying Amish things?
You know, I don't know if that's not going to help anybody. I mean, that's just going to make usually a family that doesn't have that much money have less money. So, I mean, that's not going to help anybody. The way you're going to help is by raising awareness that Amish are people. Mm-hmm. They are people. They are not saints. They are not anything other than everybody else, and they must be held accountable to the outside laws, just like everybody else. You know, take them off the pedestal. This is a community of people. They have problems just like everywhere else in the world, and they must be held accountable for those, you know, those crimes. They have crimes, and, you know, make people aware of that.
Yeah.
And stop with the tourism. I mean, the tourism is something that has helped create this problem, because, you know, the people in charge of these tourist business, they are spreading this idea. You know, come look at the quaint lifestyle, the idyllic lifestyle, the, you know, stop the, why are you touring people? It's not a zoo. I mean, why are you doing that?
Do you know of any resources where people can support, donate, volunteer to help children get out or people who want to escape the Amish?
I started a petition that's calling on Congress to make it mandatory, you know, for every school, no religious exemption, to have child sex abuse prevention education in the school and make every teacher a mandated reporter. So if you would like to let Congress know that you agree, you can sign it. If you go to change.org/Child Rights Act, you can sign the petition, and it has over 31,000 signatures. This needs to go before Congress. It needs to go before the entire nation. And people need to realize how many children, it's millions of children that are locked in cults and strict religious groups. And, you know, I'm a Christian, so I'm not like anti-religion. You know, I'm not like trying to get rid of religion. I am a Christian, but there are children across the United States that are locked in these religious groups. They can't get out. Mm-hmm. They don't have a voice. Nobody's going to help them. All they want to do is silence them, keep them quiet, because, you know, if anybody makes any fuss, then it's going to look bad on the church, on the group, on the community, on the cult, and then they're going to get outside attention, and they don't want outside attention. Mm-hmm. So somebody needs to step in. You know, everybody says, oh, we don't want big government. Somebody has got to step on, and they got to put some sort of barrier to protect these kids. Mm-hmm. And right now, there isn't any. You can, in some states, you don't even have to register if you're homeschooling. You don't even have to homeschool. I mean, yeah. You can just take kids, you can put them on a mountain like I was, and you can do whatever you want. And I mean, people are reluctant to report child abuse. I mean, this is something we got to get the nation on board. Like, yes, you report signs of child abuse. Why not? Why wouldn't you? You know, you teach kids if somebody touches you here, no. I mean, you're allowed to say something if somebody makes you uncomfortable. I mean, you are a person. You have rights. You have a voice. And right now, kids don't have rights, but they should have rights. You know, basic rights that can keep them safe.
Yeah, I agree. That's amazing. We will put the link in the description, guys. So go do that now. Hit pause and go sign that. It's so important that we get this word out. And what you're doing is incredible. And I'm so happy to have met you. And I'm so happy that you came and shared your story. It means so much that you're willing to continue to speak out. I'm sure it's difficult. And I just appreciate you coming.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, and definitely go check out her book, guys, Tears of the Silenced, on Audible, and also we'll put the links in the description. But I need you, Linda, listen. I know you have. we kind of talked about the petition already, but it's totally up to you, whatever you want to do, if you're Linda, listen.
I would just like to say, America, listen. You know, we know that children are locked in cults and religious groups, that, you know, homeschooling communities, they are locked away in these groups and they have no way to get out. They don't know what help exists for them. They don't know that they can go to the police station. And even if they did know they could go to the police station, how would they get there? You know, some of these strict religious communities like Amish, Mennonites, you know, strict FLDS, a lot of these communities, they don't even have phones. And even if you did try to pick up the phone, you're going to get caught. If you try to send a letter, you could get caught. And when you get caught in these communities, I mean, your life gets a lot worse. So, you know, we've had documentary after documentary from different religious groups come out. You know, mine, Sins of the Amish, you know. This is something that America knows about, but we're choosing to ignore it. And it's time to get it on the national stage. Who is going to help these kids? Who is going to look out for these kids? Because right now, nobody is. I mean, you can take a kid, you can move off in a cult, and you can do whatever you want. I mean, literally, whatever you want to that kid. And nobody will know. I mean, if they die, I mean, there's a chance nobody will find out. So it's time to put kids first. It's time to give kids rights. It's time to give kids, you know, the tools to fight the sexual abuse epidemic in this country. You know, 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before their 18th birthday. So it's time to put this issue first and, you know, let kids know that we care. So if you want to sign my petition, I don't know if it'll help, but I'm trying. It, you know, can try to get the attention of Congress. If you go to change.org/Child Rights Act, you can add your name and your voice to, you know, to the 31,000 that have already signed. And hopefully we can get Congress attention.
Yes. Beautifully said. Thank you so much. How can people find you aside from your book that we'll put in the description?
Well, I have my website, mistygriffin.com, and you can email me from there or see what I'm up to. And, you know, I'm just really, really trying to raise awareness about child abuse. And it takes a village. It takes a country. So it takes everybody. It's not one person that's going to rise up and put it into this. It takes everybody jumping on board and saying, yes, we need to help these kids, because there are millions of kids just like I was, you know, out there waiting for help, and they're depending on us, counting on us. So,
yeah. Great. Well, I mean, you're making a huge difference. So we appreciate everything that you're doing for this cause and for your voice and for sharing. And do any other final thoughts before we go?
Thank you for listening. I know child abuse is a hard topic, but, you know, it's constantly pushed on the back burner, and it's time. You know, we've had the Me Too movement. We've had all kinds of, you know, women's rights, you know, civil rights. I mean, now it's time for child rights. I mean, the children matter too. Children are human beings. So let's do this.
Yes. Amen. Children are our future, and we need to help them. So guys, thank you so much for watching. Leave those words of encouragement down below. Go sign the petition. Go get Misty's book. It's incredible. I highly recommend it, or listen to it on Audible like I did. And if you want to support the podcast, you can go to our website, coltstoconsciousness.com. We have some merch over there under the merch tab. You can become a patron at patreon.com/coltstoconsciousness. We are going to Costa Rica at the end of August if you want to join us. It's not going to be culty, I promise. I'm just going to have fun with you guys, get to know you a little bit more in person. And I think that's it. So if you enjoy this video, I will link two more down here below that you can check out. And until next time, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness, or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.